back into the slot. Sandy Harf is on it and they score. Cornell has increased the lead to two.
Malott shooting, he scores.
Here's Caldas, a shot, score! Yanni Caldas!
O'Neal, Dullemeyer, stop, shoots, and scores! Preston O'Neal!
And Vanderlyn drives the front, shooting, he scores!
Good evening, hockey fans, and welcome to the Good Evening Hockey Fans podcast, a hockey podcast brought to you by the Cornell Daily Sun. My name is Axel Over, senior editor on the Cornell Daily Sun, who covers the men's hockey team. And today I am joined by Rafi Gendler and Dylan McDevitt. Rafi, an assistant sports editor, soon to be sports editor, and Dylan, a sports editor, soon to be
unemployed.
Senior writer. Give yourself a little credit.
I'm back for my long sabbatical.
A little bit of a hiatus for Dylan, but we're finally back in full force on the pod.
Spring training, baseball's in the air.
Yeah, I saw my dad today fell for a gag Harper to the Yankees that he sent me. And I was like, he sent me Harper to the Yankees, and I was like frantically Googling him. Classic, is this real? And I'm like, Dad, you just got totally duped by your friends or whatever. And he was like, ah.
That's funny.
Well, good thing this is a hockey broad podcast. Well, I don't have to talk about your...
Add some color for the...
Oh, yeah, nice color, great color.
One of whom is probably my father, so he'll appreciate his shout.
Hello, what's his name?
Tim.
Hey, Tim, how's it going?
My parents stopped listening several episodes ago.
My parents never even listened. It's been a lifelong problem. Anyway, we are here to talk about some Cornell hockey.
Sure.
Big weekend for both the men and women's men's and women's team.
Big weekend behind and a big weekend ahead for both teams, indeed.
A little less big a weekend for the men behind, but yeah, I know what you mean. So let's just start with the women who... our ECAC regular season champs.
Huge.
Huge. Now they are, as a number one seed, they'll host RPI this coming weekend for a best of three series at Lina.
And assuming they win that series, they'll host the ECAC semifinals the following weekend.
The whole thing, really.
Right, could be an exciting weekend of hockey.
Could be. Will be.
Yeah, I mean, the obvious... advantage of being the number one seed is that if you can make it past the worst team in the league,
well,
the worst playoff team, the eighth seed,
a team who you just recently beat, the team eight
that
to
you,
one.
Just, you just beat yeah. 8-1, you
know, although that's maybe not a good thing, they're gonna have some motivation
anyway. Yeah, if you can get past yeah. them, then you obviously have the benefit of being able to play in the final tournament in your own building, an advantage which is, you know, obviously cannot be overstated.
Right. And if we figure it's going to be teams like Cornell, Princeton, Clarkson, Colgate, those are four teams that have been, you know, hot all season. There have been some really good games between those teams. You know, if it's not those teams, then it's a team that, you know, got hot during the playoffs, so it's going to be exciting one way or another.
The ECAC definitely is, at this point in time, you know, a hotbed for women's college hockey, that I think it's going to be really exciting down the stretch.
Well, Cornell, Clarkson, Princeton, and Colgate are, I think, all four nationally ranked, right?
Yeah,
third of the league is.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was definitely a good weekend for the women. You know, like you mentioned, dominating RPI on Friday before a little bit of a closer win over Union on Saturday, despite what the box score might have shown. Where
the Union goaltender stood on her head.
Yeah, Cornell outshot Union 62-13 in game two on the weekend. I want to say that one more time, because it's very important.
Zach's very obsessed with this.
Cornell outshot Union 62-13.
And only won 2-1.
Yeah, I mean,
That's almost the score of that Cornell football game at Princeton a few months ago.
Almost. That's like two more touchdowns than what Cornell scored. So yeah, I mean, just an utterly dominating performance for the women in that second game, despite, you know, only it being a one goal win margin. But yeah, like you mentioned, all four of the top four ECAC teams are within the rankings, with Cornell at 4, Clarkson 5, Princeton 7, and Colgate 9. So it definitely will be a bit of an exciting weekend coming up, and especially with how kind of the season ended last year, at the hands of Colgate. So just seeing kind of maybe that could get a little bit more vengeful this
yeah.
time around.
Yeah, Clarkson, of course, the defending ECAC and national champions. Cornell finally had beat Clarkson earlier this year at home on December 1st, which was, you know, the first time in a while, I think, that they had beat them. They finally kind of cracked the cracked the code with them, if you will. So
yeah, you can maybe look at that as the turning point in their season. You know, they really showed, okay, they're in business.
And they had
really
so many ties up until that weekend. Hockey. I mean, yeah. They had tied, you know, like
a, yeah, they were limping along for a while. They had, well, their coach and captain and a couple other players out playing for Team Canada for a little bit. It was a weird few weeks, and then starting with that Clarkson win, they started to kick it into high gear.
Of course, they lost at Clarkson later in the season 4-0, but right. Still a good sign. You know, you're not going to have to play at Clarkson again for as right. Long as this season goes.
Yeah, so. It goes to show you that you know, if they face Clarkson again, who knows, but that home ice could be huge. Another thing to keep an eye on is Cornell's right on the brink of the top four. If they can go win that conference tournament on their home ice, that might be enough to get them a home NCAA quarterfinals
right.
game.
Right.
You know, they're... You know, it's possible if they do everything right, they could play at home all the way to the Frozen Four, which we're counting our eggs before they hatch a little bit. But
I mean, it underscores the benefit and the importance of playing at Lina, which obviously is, you know, for both the men and the women is a huge advantage. Lina's a great place to play, and you know, they pretty much, like you just mentioned, kind of control their own destiny in that respect. You know, as long as they keep winning at Lina, they get to keep playing at Lina.
Yeah. Yeah, and that starts with taking care of business against RPI, who is not the strongest playoff opponent.
No, but I mean, they're a playoff opponent nonetheless, so yeah. They're not the worst team in the league. They are.
Certainly.
Yeah, I mean, not all 12 women's teams make it to
only 8 women's teams.
Only the top 8 do, so, I mean, it's not like we're the first round of the men's side. The number 5 seed is playing the worst team in the league. You know, you're playing a team that made it to the playoffs and made a cutoff. So, yeah, I mean, it'll definitely be, you know, really, really fun to see this weekend. And especially this championship has put head coach Doug Durow into the ECAC Coach of the Year finalist category.
Yeah.
So
well-deserved.
He's got to be the favorite, right?
I would think so.
He's so good, didn't even need to be here to coach the team to some wins during the middle of the season. But, yeah, for Cornell's first title since the...
First regular season
title since the 2012-2013 season. Unless you guys have anything else to say about...
This can help us pivot a little bit. If Cornell men's hockey takes care of business this weekend, we could have women's and men's regular season titles the same season for the first time ever.
I think
It would be the first time ever, yeah.
Which is kind of shocking given how much success both programs have had.
The women's program success is really more of a recent thing. And keep in mind, before last season, the men's last Clary Cup was 2005. So, I mean, it goes to show you how long it's been for the men. And the women, I'm not sure when their first one was. But at any rate, obviously it would be, you know, a great thing for the program. Over the weekend, I asked...
Okay, so we're transitioning fully into the men right now.
Yeah, well, I just want to drop a little Schaefer quote here. Is what Schaefer had to say about the success of both programs concurrently over the weekend. This is what Schaefer said after the Union game on Saturday.
Our programs are close. Dougie Dare and their staff, they do a tremendous job. And, you know, we see them at the rink on a day-to-day basis. So it's outstanding that they were able to clinch and be that number one seed. The biggest thing is that hopefully allow them to be at home, you know, here for the playoffs, you know, is the number one seed. So, you know, you have the ECAC championship and it's in your own rink. That's quite the advantage.
So that was Schaefer, goes to show you how, you know, it's nice for both programs to be doing well at once. And, obviously makes our jobs as the hockey reporters, more fun and interesting when both teams are doing well.
More difficult, though. Twice as many important games.
Twice as many as important games.
Yeah, sure. I wish they would suck. So it'd be a little bit easier. Both teams.
So anyways, as Zach mentioned, good transition to the men who had a really tough, tough overtime loss over the weekend to RPI. Second year in a row, they lost a heartbreaker at home to RPI. But this one, I mean, was really just... in my opinion, probably one of the tougher games I've ever covered, just in terms of, you know, really felt like Cornell did a lot of things right in that game. Really felt like they had control, you know, for much of the second and all of the third periods. Kind of the second half of the game was really all Cornell. And they gave up a couple of goals early that really were not, not the best. Goals to be giving up, that they quickly kind of got back on their feet. It was 2-1, and then in the third period, they tied it up, and it looked like the momentum was all theirs. Went to overtime, and towards the end of overtime, kind of a strange-ish goal. Ricochets off Yanni Caldas and just goes right by Matt Golladi. He pretty much had no chance, and that was the game.
Yeah. RPI is good all of a sudden. You know, they're third to last in the standings, but that's not a team I'd want to face if I'm a Dartmouth Brown Union type team in the first round of the playoffs. The goalie, Owen Savory, has been great against Cornell, not once but twice now.
Yeah, and Savory was great on Friday. He made important saves for them. I mean, in both games, I thought Golida played reasonably well. A lot of the goals he gave up really were not on him, especially that overtime goal he gave up really was not, I wouldn't put that much of that on him at all.
Yeah, he wasn't helped by the kind of whiff of a clear from Matt Nuttall, you know, just trying to get that out of the zone and just kind of fell off his stick, whiffed a little bit on it.
There were a few players who did not have, I think, their best games on Friday, Nuttall being one of them. You know, I think they were some sloppy play, especially really early on in the game.
They played well enough to start at left wing the following night.
Yes, that's another good point. So Saturday, of course, a totally different story. It was an emotional night. It was senior night. You know, as Zach just mentioned, all five seniors, you know, there are exactly five seniors, so Mike Schaefer had the brilliant idea to start them all in the game. And unfortunately, there are three defensemen and two forwards, so one of the defensemen had to start forward, and that was Matt Nuttall's job on Friday. Good for those guys to see them kind of play their last regular season home game at Lina. They won the game pretty nicely. It was a pretty good game. there was one really nice goal where Alec McRae kind of made it hit like a slap shot from the blue line, and Mitch Mandelin had his stick well placed in it, and he tipped it in, and it was kind of a nice senior night connection for the two, for the alternate captain and the captain, two seniors to kind of make that, and that was ended up being the game winning goal.
Right, and the Cornell power play stayed hot just a little over 2 minutes into the game. It was Michael Regish again, who's got I believe it's five power play goals this season,
yeah.
Second most on the team. He and Morgan Barron, among other guys, have been really good on the man advantage.
Since
the winter break, it's been
even
nice
better.
For Cornell.
Even better on the penalty kill, however.
39 in a row now for Cornell. That's nuts.
That's pretty nuts.
And I definitely recall at the beginning of the year having this conversation and saying that the special teams was really something that was unimpressive, and then they really needed to turn around. And they, at this point in the season, they are clicking on both sides.
Yeah. Yeah, and I appreciate it on a Tuesday afternoon, we heard from both Brendan Smith, the senior defenseman, and Coach Schaefer that, you know, they've been playing really well on the penalty kill. Ben Sire has been doing a great job, and also 39 in a row, you've got to get lucky. And, you know, early in the season, there were those, you know, disasters of Michigan State games. There was a tough game against Yale that they won, but the penalty kill looked like a bit of a mess, and it was, you know, in part bad play, in part bad luck, and now we're seeing they're playing well and getting lucky. It's a good combination.
Should we take a quick listen to what they had to say this past Tuesday?
Yeah, let's do it. Here's Brendan Smith.
Well, we just focused, not to sound cliche, but we've actually really dialed in on the details. And we've gotten lucky. Like, you have to get lucky to go, what'd you say, 38 in a row?
39,
38. You know, and to be able to succeed, like, you have to be a little lucky. So we've been getting some good bounces, and we've been doing everything we can to keep it out of the net. It's been a big part.
And that was Brendan Smith giving his thoughts on Cornell's recent power play penalty kill success, which is now 39 for its last 39, number one in the nation since December 1st.
And by the way, I think that dates back to January 5th, if I'm not mistaken, the consecutive
39 in a row
penalty kills.
Yes, I think it was either Quinnipiac or
don't
Benson.
Don't quote me on that, but it's roughly around that time.
I think it's I think
and,
you're right.
And since December 1st, their power play is what, third in the
third at I think 21.9.
Yeah, it was over
like
30
that.
For a while. It's leveled off just a little bit.
I mean, you know, it's just kind of funny. They've given up more goals on the on their own power play in the past, whatever,
one,
10 some odd
one
games.
1-0.
1-0 than they have on the penalty kill, because Union got one shorthanded goal on Saturday. But yeah, no, I mean, that the special teams definitely seem to be coming into its own. Which has been a little bit more impressive, just given, you know, some of the injuries. I mean, Cornell, you know, don't get me wrong, they're getting healthy now, so injuries are becoming a little bit less of a...
No, to an extent. I mean, they're still missing some guys that you'd like to see contributing.
It's really just, besides Cody, who's out for the year, it's really just Max.
Right.
Yeah, and Andreev, we expect to be back not this weekend, but probably, hopefully, for the playoffs is the prognosis we
Which
got.
Which is kind of what they've been saying.
From Schaefer on Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, when you if you were to map out the time, I mean, collarbone injury, just a quick Google search will give you 4 to 6 weeks. And, you know, about the six-week mark from when he got injured is about first week of playoffs. So he's practicing right now in a non-contact jersey. Schaefer said it on Tuesday. So I think it would be very safe to assume he'll be back by the first round. Yeah.
And the bye week, he was looking good, not totally locked up for Cornell. They need a point or for Yale to not get all 4 points this weekend. But a bye week is really desperately needed. And
almost
it's
more
gonna
so.
It's going to be a huge sigh of relief when
so
if they clinch it.
This brings up a good point about the playoff scenario. So basically, Cornell can be anywhere between first and fifth. In order to be top four, like you just mentioned, Rafi, they have to not lose out, and Yale has to not win out.
In other words, if Cornell goes 0-2 and Yale goes 2-0, that's the only way that Cornell does not get a bye.
So
even with that, I mean, if you know Harvard or some of the other teams lose out too,
right,
like Cornell could
yeah.
keep its stand. Yeah. But the most common scenario for the most probable way Cornell loses out on its first round bye is by getting swept and Yale sweeping,
yeah.
which isn't easy given that Yale is playing Quinnipiac and Princeton, but they are playing them at home.
Yeah, that Yale-Quinnipiac game is one to keep an eye on. Should be a great game.
So then the question becomes, you know, functionally speaking, what is the difference between being the 4 seed and the 1 seed? There are a few important differences. Basically, your positioning within the top four determines A, who you play in the second round, in the quarterfinal. You know, if you're the 1 seed, you would play the worst remaining seed of the bottom eight, and if you're the 4 seed, you would play the best remaining seed of the bottom eight. So that's, you know, a valuable thing. The other thing is that when you go to Lake Placid, if you do go there, being the 1 seed gives you...
You get to wear your white jersey instead of your red one? Is there
you get the bigger locker room, which is whatever. But you
huge.
More importantly, you get the right of last change.
Oh, sure, okay.
Which for a team like Cornell that... At that time, depending on how healthy they are, you know, that can be a huge advantage, especially if they end up being a little bit shorthanded injury-wise. Having the right of last change is definitely something you'd rather have than not having it. So those are the differences, really. To be honest, functionally speaking, probably not a huge difference. I mean,
between 1 and 2 or 2 and 3.
Yeah, even between 1 and 4, obviously you'd prefer 1, but the difference is not, I think, disastrous. It's not season altering. You know, you play maybe the 5 or the 6 seed instead of playing the 7 or the 8
right.
seed.
Yeah, the bye is huge, and also, you know, there's some.
It's the bye.
There's also some pride in winning the Cleary Cup. That's a big deal. And
I think guns ahead, in a scenario where they could only win either the Cleary or a bye, I think they would choose a bye. I mean, obviously the Cleary Cup automatically gets a bye, but in a scenario where the Cleary winner doesn't get a bye. I think if you take the pride of a Cleary or the time of a bye, you take the bye.
The culture is to, I mean, it's clear, right, that they don't even hang Cleary Cup banners.
Right.
And it's been stated by members of the team and team personnel many times over that while the Cleary Cup is a nice thing to have, it's really not what their goal is. I mean, sure, it's a nice accolade to pick up along the way to what is the actual goal, which is winning a league championship at Lake Placid. You know, that's what they want. I think if you offer them, you know, no Cleary Cup and a Lake Placid championship or vice versa, you know, there would be no hesitation on which one they chose. So the Cleary Cup is, while nice, really not, you know, they don't even hang the banners, like I said, so it's not something, I mean, they care more about winning the Ivy League than they care about winning the regular season ECAC title, because they hang those banners.
Well, it all goes back to Harvard coach Cleary not shaking hands at the end of whatever year that was.
Oh, yes.
Well, they used to not even touch the Cleary Cup, legend has it, right?
Wait, well, they've only, since Bill Cleary left Harvard, they've only won it twice, I think. 2003 and 2005.
Yeah, okay. What about last year?
Well, I was just saying, before last year.
Oh, okay.
No, they won 2002, 2003, and 2004, 2005.
Oh, so they won 3 times.
Yeah.
But last year it was,
no, that was 1 year gap.
It was confirmed to me at some point last year that they did in fact touch the Cleary Cup. So
Wow! Breaking news. Don't reveal those sources, because that.
But if you recall, we were actually there. Because they wanted RPI in Troy. We were actually there, and they did not do any sort of on ice ceremony. It was all.
It's also not their home ice.
Right.
Still, though, you would expect.
You think RPI is going to sit around and love to see Cornell get a?
What if they wanted it home? Do you think they would do a?
No.
I don't know.
They do it in the locker room. I've never seen
them clinch anything at home.
I'm just saying
besides
that,
the playoff series.
Well, the Ivy League title.
Yeah, they
sort of. But that was. I mean, they were playing St. Lawrence. It was results elsewhere.
Right.
Let's talk about the NCAA tournament chances looking way ahead here. A loss to St. Lawrence on Friday at the risk of being overdramatic would be a bit of a disaster if you're Cornell.
Yeah, that could be damning, a loss then. And St. Lawrence,
it would maybe mean they have to win the CAC at Lake Placid.
It could. Right. I mean, St. Lawrence, I mean, it would depend what they do against Clarkson the next night, I think. But
right.
St. Lawrence right now, number 59, second to last in the pairwise, a loss to them could easily prove to be, you know, kind of throw a wrench into the plan, especially that Cornell's, according to the College Hockey News Monte Carlo simulations, that their percentage into the tournament right now is down to 77%. I think it was up in the 80s to 90s last time we recorded.
The lost RPI did not help.
Definitely not. And it's unfortunate. I mean, it's unfortunate just like because, you know, obviously in the NHL, you at least get a point for overtime. You don't get anything for an overtime loss.
You don't get anything.
So, yeah, Cornell, you know, if they lose on Friday against St. Lawrence, that could prove to be pretty costly in the long run. I'm not so sure that they have to win.
Are they 11th in the pairwise now?
They're 11th.
Okay.
I'm not so sure that they have to win the ECACs to get in. Perhaps at least making it to the title game or making it to Lake Placid. I think if they sweep this weekend and make it to Lake Placid, they're in.
Oh, for sure.
For sure.
Even if they sweep this weekend and, well, yeah.
Keep in mind, they haven't swept the North Country since 2005, so it's been quite some time.
The other important thing to note is that while yes, perhaps losing at, you know, in the quarterfinal at home would be bad, it also doesn't give them a chance to lose again later, which hurts you in the pairwise. So I mean, I'm not sure how it would shake out, but if they were to sweep this weekend, let's say, and then, you know, lose in three games in the quarterfinal, I'm not sure that would totally knock them out, depending on who they lost to, because they won't have a chance to lose again. That'll be it. They'll be waiting to see how everything else shakes out.
Well, also, I mean, you know, it also depends on the kind of somehow these other tournaments shape out, because, you know,
I mean, look what happened with Princeton last year.
Princeton last year, they basically stole a bid, an at-large bid from someone else, because there was Cornell and Clarkson, who basically deserved to get in the tournament just based on their year-long resume, and all of a sudden
everybody assumed one of the two would win the championship.
Right, and all of a sudden Princeton kind of steals that automatic bid. So down the line, you got to look at some of these other potential at-large teams in the NCAA, and one of those teams loses their spot.
Right. Well, and look at the Big Ten this season. Ohio State is a lock, but if they don't win the conference tournament, a team like Notre Dame, Penn State, Minnesota, they're all outside the top 16 now. They could mess with things a little
bit.
But
you have to, even still, like, it can have effects. Like, I think, I don't remember exactly last year, but maybe one of you guys will. There was the best team that didn't make it last year was, like, not ranked 15th or 16th. They were ranked, like, 12th or something in the pairwise.
Yeah.
And they got, like, bumped out. So, I mean, even where Cornell stands right now, I mean, 11th, you're probably safe, but, I mean,
yeah,
you drop down to 12th or 13th, you know, you're looking at getting boxed out potentially by a team who, you know, comes out of nowhere and wins an automatic qualifier bid.
Right. So even though Clarkson is the, you know, sexier game, it's number one against number two in the conference, you know, potential Lake Placid preview. St. Lawrence on Friday
is actually
the must win. I think Clarkson moved into second place.
Third place,
okay.
1 point behind Harvard and Quinnipiac.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's kind of a little unfortunate, I guess, as from a journalist perspective, is like no one cares about this St. Lawrence Cornell game in terms of quality of play, but in terms of actual what you should be promoting in terms of what game has more importance, you could easily make the argument that Friday night is more important than Saturday night.
And you know, you look at St. Lawrence's record and pairwise ranking, and they're bad. They're not terrible if you look at recent games, you know, who they've played. It's not, I mean, who knows? It, you know, it's their senior weekend. It's probably not a cakewalk up there.
No, they've had, I mean,
they tied last year, I believe, 1-1.
Yeah, on the road, right. And they Cornell beat them at home 3-1. It wasn't, you know, a nail-biter, but it wasn't
It was 5-0 Clarkson on Friday night, and then only a 3-1 win against St. Lawrence, and even the 3-1 was a little bit closer than the score suggests. I mean, the second half of the season...
Sorry, it was a 1-0 win, not a 1-1 tie last year at St. Lawrence. And Jeff Malott.
And a 0-0 tie with Clarkson on the road. Yeah, I mean, St. Lawrence, they only have one win in the second half of the season, but at home, they're especially tough to play. Their one win came against Princeton at home, and outside of a blowout loss to Quinnipiac, every single loss they've had at home this season, the second half has only been by one goal. So, you know, Cornell kind of walking in there, and I don't think they're going to treat it like a cakewalk by any means, but, you know, even if...
Schaefer would never let that happen.
No, of course not. But even if St. Lawrence only has four wins on the year, you know, the second half has been a bit of a resurgence without much wins, at least to show for it. You know, they tied Dartmouth. They only lost to Harvard by one. They beat Princeton, like I said.
Harvard, they went up 2-0 and then blew it, I think, 3-2, right?
Yeah, tied Union, or lost by one to Union and to RPI. So, I mean, yeah, like I said, like the Saturday night's game isn't going to be, Friday night's game isn't the sexiest in terms of quality of teams and standing, as far as standings go, but in terms of NCAA implications, right. Easily.
Well, and if they win Friday, they'll have locked up a bye.
Friday, yeah,
the game Saturday becomes actually not that crucial, even though it's a fun one and two really good teams, two, you know, top 15 teams in college hockey.
Yeah, I mean, I think they do want to win the regular season title.
Oh, for sure.
I think, yeah.
And the number one seed's valuable. You get better position all the way through.
Right, and last year we saw, you know, the kind of...
And big for the pairwise, too. Clarkson's a
right, exactly.
Quality win, for sure.
I mean, Schaefer said on Tuesday that, you know, no matter what, he's not going to treat Saturday any differently if they win on Friday. But, I mean, kind of different from last year where they also had to go on the road for the final two games of the year. We're able to lock up the Clear Cup on Friday night and the number one seed, obviously. So Saturday night they kind of threw in Hayden Stewart to play. You know, not everyone maybe rolled four lines a little bit more casually, and they ended up getting obviously trounced by Union.
Four or three, or something like that.
How many power play goals? It wasn't like three power play goals or something.
Yeah, they got their ass kicked on the penalty kill, but I wouldn't say they got trounced. What was it like a?
It was 4-3.
4-3 game.
All right, like not trounced.
Anyways, yeah, I mean, look, the point of this is that St. Lawrence, obviously, we've been talking about very important game. I don't anticipate any sort of, you know, morale deficiency on their part. I think they understand how important it is, and look, I think maybe in this conversation we've given St. Lawrence a little more credit than they deserve. I mean, they're a putrid hockey team. They have won four games the whole season and just two games since November 17th.
They beat Minnesota early in the year, which is nuts.
Yes, because
at Minnesota, right?
Yeah, that's at Minnesota. Silliest thing ever. Yes, they did beat Minnesota at Minnesota in overtime on November 16th, which was their second win of the season. But since then, they've only won two, and that's a very, very long time. They lose a lot of games. They lose to just about everybody.
But they lose by one goal, which means one crappy bounce, and Cornell's in trouble.
Well,
two crappy bounces.
You lose by one goal 26 times, I think.
Cornell should win. If you lose a must-win game to St. Lawrence in March,
they don't deserve to be in the tournament. Yeah. So if Cornell is the tournament team that we think they are, they will win. And if they aren't, then maybe they won't. I think St. Lawrence is an opponent that you're looking for Cornell to take care of. And you know, and then, of course, it's all about Clarkson the following night, you know, which is not at all an easy game.
No. Well, kind of what you mentioning, you know, Cornell should take care of them. But you know, so far this season, they've had a couple games like that, notably Colgate at home, RPI at home and on the road, Michigan State to open the year.
The Yale game.
Yeah, Yale's a good team. I wouldn't say they should. I mean, maybe Brown a little bit more than Yale. But, you know, games that, you know, Cornell kind of... I mean, I feel like most games this season they've entered being expected to win. But, some of these games where they were really expected to win, like the ones I just mentioned, and they just weren't able to get it done in those games. And, you know, kind of... Obviously, you want those points, and, you know, you're never going to say, oh, I'm glad we lost that game. But, you know, just from my perspective, I think some of that time it could be beneficial in the long run. You know, they met, we'll listen to Brendan Locke mention in a second, but they didn't really face much adversity at all last year. They were pretty much...
Yeah, their only losing streak was their final two games of the season, right. The loss in the ECAC semifinals.
Which is kind of a narrative that we were peddling a little bit earlier in the season when they dropped the first two games to Michigan State. Which, I mean, last year they won, what, their first eight or something in a row?
Seven or eight.
So, I mean, that dichotomy has been there already all season long. You know, they've been facing adversity beginning, middle, and now end. I mean, you look at what happened against RPI over the weekend. And even the Yale and Brown series before that was, I mean, to go on that series and come home with 1 point is probably really not what you were looking for.
No, well, not at all.
If they had gotten 4 points, that we can, you know, we'd be talking now about, you know, they can rest some starters, clinch the Clary Cup, right. For sure the bye. It's a whole different story.
Yeah, well, that was the first three games without a win for Cornell since the start of the 2016-2017 season. So
yeah.
it's been a bit of some time, and that's just kind of, that in itself is pretty remarkable. Just being able to go three games and at least find one win somewhere, and just kind of pick up those points every here and there. But let's give a listen to what Brendan Locke had to say just about facing adversity this year and how it might pay off, you know, come the end of March, beginning of April.
Adversity is always good. I think one of the things we didn't really have last year was as much adversity. So we never really had to, like, I don't even think, did we lose two games in a row last year?
Not until
the last two games, right? So, like, losing a few games, tying, not really getting those points is tough, but adversity is what you have to face in order to win and be a successful hockey team. So the fact that we can face that now and look at that and learn from it, I think it's really going to help us, like, going into playoffs.
And that was Brendan Locke giving his two cents about how adversity might help this team so
beginning
far.
Of April, you're optimistic.
Well, who knows?
You never know.
We got a
little road trip to Buffalo, anybody?
I'm down for Buffalo.
Isn't it over spring break? I won't be here.
No. The it's
Allentown. Or
the,
hopefully
the
Allentown.
First and second rounds are the beginning of spring break.
Yeah, first and second round.
April 11th or something.
First weekend of spring break, and then two weekends until the Frozen Four, and then Buffalo, which would be take us to April. Which I'm hopeful if they are in Allentown, then I can definitely go to those games because I'll at least be around the first couple days of spring break. But I'm really, really hoping for Allentown because I got to get to New York City for a flight on Monday.
The games are on Saturday?
It would either be Friday. I'm not sure if Allentown is Friday, Saturday games or Saturday, Sunday games.
In theory, I could do a Friday game, but I'm flying out on Saturday from Newburgh, New York.
Oh, yes, you're going.
I'm leaving here the Thursday. I thought
you guys were flying out of Hartford.
No, we considered it.
Where are you going?
Where am I going? We're going to Europe.
Oh, yeah, you were telling me about this. Europe. You can fly from Hartford to...
Yes, you can fly from Hartford to Dublin. We're flying from Stewart Airport, Newburgh, to Dublin.
Where's that?
In the middle of nowhere.
Okay, fun.
On the Hudson River.
All right, well, back to the Good Evening Hockey Fans podcast. I also want to listen to one more thing from Media Day this week. You know, with Clarkson the second night, it's kind of a weird situation each time that... Cornell Clarkson face off, you know, kind of highlighted by last year's 0-0 tie. Cornell and Clarkson just are very similar teams, play relatively similar styles, a lot of recruit kind of similarly in terms of their player makeup and identity. A lot of big guys, a lot of strong power forwards, and you know, there's obviously been some
both close to Canada.
Both close to Canada. There's obviously been some, you know, diverging towards the more speed and skill, but you know, Casey Jones, the head coach at Clarkson, served under Schaefer for a number of years. Brent Brecky, the assistant coach under Casey Jones, served under Schaefer for a number of years.
Did Jones and Schaefer overlap here at all? Because Jones graduated Jones was, in 90.
Oh, in terms Schaefer of playing.
87. Oh, so no,
they never. No, I don't think. Okay. Maybe there might have been one weird year where he started early or something like that.
No, okay.
But no, in terms of playing, I don't think they really overlapped. But I asked Schaefer just about if it's ever weird kind of seeing his systems play out in the form of Clarkson systems now, and he gave a pretty interesting answer, so let's take a listen.
They play some stuff, but their forecheck is different. Their offensive zone play is different. You know, their penalty killing is a little bit different. But I think they're a lot of the same fundamentals. But, you know, Casey has got his own take on how he plays, and he's they're very successful at it. And you know, so I mean, I think we all mold things. I mean, the stuff that we're doing here, Casey helped us mold that. Brent Brecky's and the other assistant was here for a long time with me. You know, a lot of the things we do, they help mold what we've done here too. So it's not like, you know, they just took, they gave a lot while they were here. And, you know, so you take ideas with what those guys had. They're good coaches, and, you know, that's the way coaching business is like. You learn from each other.
And that was head coach Mike Schaefer just talking about kind of how Casey Jones has evolved as a coach at Clarkson, and Brent Brecky, an assistant coach, both two coaches who have coached under him here at Cornell. And I kind of liked how he mentioned that not only has their systems mimicked, but they've also, it's because they created some of those systems at Cornell. Mm-hmm. It's not that they stole anything. I mean, he says the coaches steal from each other all the time, but what happens here at Cornell is because of what those guys brought to the table here. So I thought that was a little bit interesting, and maybe a good way to wrap up our Clarkson and St. Lawrence preview. And then
head, do we have some listener questions?
We got a pair of listener questions.
Great. Ooh. Thanks very much to our listeners. As a reminder, if you've got anything on your mind Cornell hockey related, or just anything you'd like our thoughts on, we're on Twitter and can be reached via email too. sports@cornellsun.com is one of the many ways you can find us.
Or tweeting us at Daily Sun Sports, at any of our personal Twitter handles, at Zach Silver, at Rafi underscore Gendler, at DC McDevitt underscore. So what do we want to talk about first? We want to talk about Cornell's kryptonite or the scoreboard?
I like the scoreboard question, and it actually is a very interesting question. So the question is, why at line of rink at home games do they wait until the period is over before updating the shots on goal portion of the scoreboard?
And this question comes from Ed Farmer at DWardo23 on Twitter. Thanks for your question, Ed.
So there are two reasons for this. The first is that the first is for accuracy purposes. So everything is kind of certified, if you will, after a period ends. So
well, at other arenas, they put it up on the board, but that's unofficial.
It's the unofficial. Right. So they don't do that. There's no unofficial. It's only until once the count is official that they put it up. The second reason is that the scoreboard is old, and I think it's difficult for Brandon, who scores the games, to be recording shot. The scoreboard is not connected to the stat program.
Right.
The scoreboard is manually operated.
Right. Yeah.
So you'd have to communicate between the scorer, who does not touch the scoreboard, and the scoreboard person, who I think sits across the ice.
Yeah, he sits next to the
yeah, bench. So there's no way to
communicate. So what does the woman on the end who sits a couple seats away from us do?
I have no idea.
I don't know. But the real reason is that the scoreboard is old and operated by a person literally pressing buttons, which is across the ice from the press box where the Brandon, the scorer, sits, and he decides what's a shot or what's not.
Because it's not obvious. It's hard to tell.
It's Brandon's job to decide that.
If it's just like somebody sitting at ice level, it's hard to know.
So unless you got like a walkie-talkie from Brandon to the scoreboard operator, which would be super annoying.
And he has to report every time there's a shot.
Or the scoreboard operator just guessed.
Right.
It's different at places where the scoreboard is often hooked up to the stat program, which is sidearm in our case. And so when Brandon would input shot to the sidearm program, it would automatically just feed to the scoreboard. But line of scoreboard is too old for that.
Now, do they... No, that's a dumb question. They do import it to the computer right away, so never mind. Yes, I was going to say they do the paper shot charts too.
Yes, and
maybe they go off of that at the end of the period. They look at the paper, they say 11 shots on goal.
Yeah,
and kind of like you mentioned, like Colgate does, they have a brand spanking new arena, all the bells and whistles, most notably a video board right above the center ice. And they do have the guys, I don't know if their clock is in the box. I think it's the scoreboard itself, the video board is operated from the press box, but I think maybe the score and the numbers might be done, I'm not certain, might be done at ice level. Instead of just waiting till the end of the period, the guy sitting in the box, I think, will kind of make his own judgments. And then once he gets the official scoring from the SID at Colgate, he'll put the official score on the board, which I didn't really like, because I didn't know that's how it worked at the beginning. So I was started like tweeting that those were the shots on goal, and all of a sudden I looked up and they were changed.
This happened to us at Clarkson last year. I think we had to like wait for a while. Anyway, yeah, it is.
I don't recall.
It's unfortunate for us and the fans.
It's fortunate for us as long as we remember that it's unofficial.
Well, even no,
because for fans it's good. You get sort of an idea,
right? But not just speaking about line. It's unfortunate just because it takes a while for us to finally figure out what the shots are.
Yeah,
especially during the game when the Wi-Fi line sucks and we can't figure it out always just through our. Because even if the Wi-Fi is good, like the stats operates on the same Wi-Fi as us, so they're still getting stuff online.
The other thing to note is that we do get to see during the game how many shots on goal there are, because we have the stat program in front of us, which updates live, which is, like I mentioned earlier, is
A fan. I was going to say,
if you ever are curious, you can go to Sidearm, which if you go to the Cornell Sports website and go to whichever game you want, there's a little section that says live stats. If you click on that, it'll take you to the Sidearm page, which you can see, you know, the roughly updated.
It gives you basically what the ESPN app would give you for an NBA game.
Right, but at the same time, because Brandon and the stats people work on the same Wi-Fi that we do, sometimes their updates are not as up-to-date as the game is.
Right.
You know, obviously when you have NHL games, a lot much higher grade stuff, that's the game pretty updated. But, you know, sometimes they're just following the games from home or something, trying to follow live stats, and there'll really be, like, 5 minutes left in the period, and I'll say like 12 minutes left in the period, and I won't have the stats.
Yeah.
That's enough about scoreboard talk.
A good question, though, that I was excited to answer when I saw.
It'll actually be a little bit interesting to see how things happen next year, because to my understanding, they're going to be putting in a full video board into the rink next
year.
They've been saying that for a while, though.
I thought Brandon.
We'll see.
Did Brandon say it was a
Brandon mentioned it was going to happen next season.
Cool.
Shane, yeah. Right. You'll get to enjoy it. Zach and I will be gone.
Yeah. I think maybe they'll broadcast a drumline intro on that.
Oh, jeez. Did anybody ask a question about that? I'm not a fan. I've only seen it a couple times.
It's a cool idea, but it's like...
It's everything that Lina Rink isn't.
Yeah.
I think.
I thought it's fun. I'm a little partial.
I thought the drum... I appreciate the effort to spice things up.
They are talented. We're not saying the drumming is cool. It sounds good.
Yeah.
You guys, I don't know if you might have been there, but the first time they did it,
they screwed it
was
up,
really right? rough. They were like behind.
No, I wasn't there. I was there the second time. And
they were like under the scoreboard.
Yeah,
right?
It was really awkward, really bizarre, and it didn't work well. The second time they actually went to the stands, I thought it was a little bit better. You know, I do have a soft spot for the just a classic going onto the ice, but I don't know. Cornell's such an old school program. I think it's not bad to put some. Yeah. Innovations in there every now and then.
I'm kind of a purist. I like, you know, play the fight song, team takes the ice, people cheer. What do I know?
The introductions were done a little more with some more pizzazz, you know? Like maybe like the lights go off and there's like a little spotlight or whatever. There's no spotlight.
Well, it's hard with the roof so low to want to do anything like that. All right, so let's go to our second listener question.
This one is more directly hockey related.
Just made up our own listener question. So this one comes up from...
I wanted to fetch a little bit about the drum.
This question comes from, I think, second or third time questioner, N. Santa Maria, at N. Santam on Twitter. And she asks, hello, me again with a hockey question. What's a kryptonite for the men's team in terms of strategy/style? What makes them struggle when playing against it? Thanks.
It's a really good question.
It's a hard question
to answer, and I'm willing to wager we'll all have slightly different answers.
I don't know if I have an answer, so why don't you guys go first, and we'll see.
What do you think, Zach?
I think Cornell is just really good at kind of controlling, or not really control. I think where they struggle, actually, is when they play lower-grade teams. They will usually settle down to how that team plays instead of setting the pace themselves. I think, you know, you see that, especially in the Colgate... some of the RPI games, Michigan State at the beginning of the year. Oh, Michigan State kind of walked all over them. I think, you know, at least as the season has gone on, Cornell's kind of had the tendency, you know, you hear a lot of people, you know, they say during the week, play our game and not worry about that or whatever. But I think, yeah, sometimes they kind of get away from that a little bit and we'll just kind of fall into habits of just playing to the tune of whatever this team was. You know, I felt like in the RPI game, even though they dominated, or at least in the one earlier in the year, they kind of were playing a little bit down and allowed RPI to stay in the game when they could have basically run away with it. Obviously, you know, goalies play a big part in that in some of these games that, you know, the Colgate goaltender and Owen Savory at RPI basically has helped steal the game for them. But I think Cornell kind of struggles. Maybe it's in their head. I don't think so. I wouldn't think a team like that would have that kind of problem. But it just feels like whenever they play teams that are kind of lower quality that they play down to them instead of making them play up to them.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good answer. That definitely is something that sticks out to me. If you had asked me this question a while ago, I would have told you the special teams.
Teams with good
special teams. But obviously now they've been so good at that as of late. You know, I don't think that suffices as an answer to what their kryptonite is. Zach, you touched on it a little bit. I think when they run into a goaltender who is having a good night, it can be increasingly difficult for them to win games because I've noticed, especially in the games where they tie or lose and it feels like they should win, it's just these are games where they have a ton of chances and they just can't follow through. They just can't finish. That becomes increasingly difficult when you have a guy in the net who is doing his job well, a guy who doesn't give up rebounds, who doesn't give you easy open looks. When I think sometimes they struggle, even in games that they win, to really bury the chances that are point blank, front and center. You know, maybe if they get, let's say, 8 or 9 of those chances a game.
We saw that in the loss to the home overtime loss to Colgate.
If they get 8 or 9 chances like that a game, they should be burying 2 or 3 of them, but in reality they're burying 0 or 1. And, you know, it feels like when they run into a goalie who is very good, and or at least is playing very well, like they have with Owen Savory a couple of times, those opportunities, they have more like 3 of those opportunities in a game, and it becomes even harder to bury. So their finishing ability, I think, if you run into a hot goaltender, I think their offensive abilities are kind of strangled in a way.
Mm-hmm. And I think they, you know, kind of going off that, they also, some teams get a tendency to kind of play hero mode where some, you know, if they're really struggling against a goalie or just getting snake bitten, where one guy will kind of try and take it upon himself to make that change. And I think that's kind of when Cornell gets out of whack and kind of,
I don't know that happens that futs. Often with them. I think they have a lot of talented players who, I mean, if you look at just the top line alone, right? You know, if you're a Cornell fan and you're down by a goal late in the game and you see that top line on the ice, you should feel comfortable. You should feel hopeful, right? Because that's a line with 3 very, very, very talented players who are capable of making game-breaking plays. I think what you said, Zach, was spot on. And I just want to add that, like I said, a talented, hot goaltender who is not giving them any, you know, slack to work with is particularly troublesome. And obviously that is for any team, but I think particularly for a team like Cornell, which at times this year has struggled to score in big moments, I think that can really kill you.
Yeah. I couldn't think of a good answer to the question, but I want to briefly answer the reverse question. I think Cornell this season and in general does really well against teams that are good because they have a couple of good players but lack depth. I'm thinking of Princeton. You know, they've got Kuffner and Verano, these 2 stars. Cornell, you know, smacked him once and beat him in a close one once. Then Arizona State came to town, you know, this up-and-coming, exciting, nationally ranked team. This guy, Johnny Walker, is a stud. Their goaltender played great, but Cornell really, smacked him around pretty easily. I think Cornell, you know, is really responsible defensively, their defensemen and forwards.
Super disciplined.
They do really well against teams that have, you know, a strong top line but aren't so great but don't have a good deep lineup because they can put pretty much anybody up against the Kuffners and the Johnny Walkers of the world.
I think that's a really good point. I would say also that, you know, put another way, I think Cornell is really good at exposing teams that are not as good as maybe they appear to be on their face. Yeah. Teams like Arizona State. Cornell is a very disciplined, system-based hockey team, and their game plan doesn't change a whole lot from game to game.
And part of that's a Schaefer thing. He's old school. He knows what's going on. He likes defense.
And he's got a system, and they have a system. And they stick to you hear it all the time in prep, stick to our systems, stick to our systems. They say that all the time. And it's because their system is effective. And it's effective particularly, like you said, against teams that, you know, it's practically built for teams that have guys who are good shooters, but that's about it. You know, teams like that, that's like easy breakfast for them.
That's a new saying.
That's a new saying.
Easy breakfast. That's it. That's the name of this episode. Easy breakfast.
Well, no matter what happens with Cornell's systems and with their level of play against the far inferior St. Lawrence this coming weekend, we'll be sure to discuss it next week on the next edition of the Good Evening Hockey Fans podcast. Again, if you have any listener questions, please email them to sports@cornellsun.com or tweet us at Zach Silver, at Rafi_Gendler, at DC_McDevitt.
I really should change my Twitter handle, huh?
That's all we got this week on the Good Evening Hockey Fans podcast. We'll catch you back next week. Good evening, hockey fans.
See ya.